did two things. First of all, we wanted to move from the kinematical phase, Hilbert space that we had for an edge to kinematical Hilbert space for an entire graph. And then we wanted to actually move from the kinematical to the physical Hilbert space. And the first step to doing this is to quantize the Gauss constraint. And the final product of the work of last lecture was to get to spin network states, which are solutions once we quantize the Gauss constraint. So first, to get from the edge to a graph, what we assumed, and it's a sensible assumption, is that we can treat the graph as just we have a connection of all the edges and they're independent. So everything that we build is going to be a tensor product. The Hilbert space of a graph is going to be simply a tensor product of all Hilbert spaces that we had for an edge. So in this case, it's square integrable function over SU2. And this allowed us to furthermore describe things such as states for a graph, inner product, and also an orthonormal basis that we use. And that is one of the key parts because we actually use it later on as well, which is just to say, again, that we have labels J, M, N for individual edges, and we get them from just tensor products of all the J, M, N labels, and then that's our description of the graph. Then to move from that to actually a physical Hilbert space, we need to somehow impose the Gauss constraint on a quantum level. And we saw that it's difficult to do that if we just look at the Gauss constraint for what it is, you know, D plus epsilon EA. What we instead did was we said, OK, well, this is a first class constraint that we know generates a gauge transformation. And we have how our holonomies transform under these gauge transformations. So what we're going to do now is we're going to say, OK, let's see how the states also transform under a gauge transformation. And let's try to impose on a quantum level our Gauss constraint through the change of the states. And we found that actually what we simply get is that the states transform with the left and right actions that we defined in the lecture in more detail. So once we had this transformation of the states, we actually wanted to find the solutions to the Gauss constraint. That is, we wanted to identify the states that are actually invariant under these transformations. And we took an example of an edge with a source and a target as its endpoints. And we said, OK, for a state living on this edge, what would be the solution to the Gauss constraint? And we actually found that to do this, we need to think of group averaging at the two ends, the source and the target. And the result of this is a very trivial solution that is just a constant. So this we did, but we didn't get much interesting result, many interesting results from it. Actually, what we found later that was more interesting was to look at something like this, which is a three-valent vertex. And the one we worked with specifically was one with three sources, but it doesn't actually matter. You can look at any type of a three-valent vertex you want. And we said, OK, if you have a state, now look back to how we defined the state of a graph. And we said we have something here, and we're going to say it's just a tensor product of something living on the three edges. How can we solve this? What is the solution to the Gauss constraint in this case? And after recoupling theory magic and imposing normalization on our solutions, we found that actually we can write the solution to this in the basis that we have. But we now have to introduce these three JM symbols. And the three JM symbols are called intertwiners. So we decorate our graphs so that every vertex now has another label to it that is actually I, whatever the coefficients here are. So we did this, and we wanted to say, OK, well, this is true for this area of my graph, but I want to be able to make many different combinations. And then we got to the spin network state, which is actually just incorporating what we said about the three-valent vertex, but is doing it in general for saying, OK, if I combine lots of vertices, then I'll just have to repeat what I had before, and I'll take the product of all the intertwiners defined every vertex, and I'll have to go through all the edges, and I'll get something that describes my entire state. And the effect of everything that we did was to actually reduce a graph like this that was previously described in terms of tensor products of labels J, M, N for each edge to something that is described only in terms of labels J for every edge and intertwiners living on each vertex. So in a sense, the Gauss constraint actually told us that the M and Ns that we had here are not as free as we thought they would be. It actually turns out that when we impose a Gauss constraint on each vertex, we'll have some connections, and we'll have to right now, everything in terms of the intertwiners. And then, yeah, next step is flatness and moving on. Okay.
Okay, great. Any question on that? Or? Okay, so the spin network states here are really the fundamental excitation of our space, okay? And now what I want to do, so in 4D gravity, I'm going to talk about 4D tomorrow. We can go until this step, okay? We will have spin network states defining on a 3D surface, and then we will still have to implement the dynamics, but in 3D, we can implement the flatness constraint. But to do that, to implement the flatness constraint, it's quite difficult to do it in general, like abstractly. So I'm going to do it on the specific example I introduced just at the end of this lecture, where we consider this graph associated to, so this is the, if you consider that your canonical manifold, so your 2D surface, is a two-sphere, okay? You can triangulate this two-sphere using four triangles glued together in this way, and then the graph of your spin network would be the dual graph, okay? And in fact, a nice geometrical interpretation I won't really have time to give here is that imposing, so you see that dual to a vertex with three edges is going to be a triangle, and in fact, the Gauss constraint is really, you could show that the Gauss constraint totally determine what is this quantum triangle at the quantum level. So you can compute everything from your Gauss constraint. You can get the area, the angles, and all the information you want at the quantum level. So here, what you have is each vertices can be, the dual is a triangle. And what is going to do the flatness constraint? The flatness constraint is going to tell you how to glue together these four triangles in order to form a tetrahedron, which is embedded in a flat space-time. Okay? Because now the fact of the flatness constraint is the dynamic, so it's the embedding in the 3D space. Okay? And what the flatness constraint is really going to tell you is that you're going to glue together four triangles in a flat embedding space-time. Okay? And you can really, at the classical level with discrete geometry, you can really show that explicitly nicely. What does it mean in terms of just angles and some nice geometry? But I don't have so much time to do this here, so I'm just going here to talk about how to implement this flatness constraint at the quantum level on this specific graph. Okay, so here I'm considering that I'm at this stage, meaning that I already imposed the Gauss constraint at each vertices. So each vertices now, I have the SU2 invariance. So this state is described by a spin network state, which can be decomposed here, where here, since we have four vertices again, we have four intertwiner, which is associated to each vertex. And we're going to see how this flatness constraint is going to relate them together. Okay, so let's go to the flatness constraint, and maybe I can just so here imposing the flatness constraint amounts to solve the dynamics of the problem, and of course you remember that when we go from in the parametrized particle. From the kinematical Hilbert space to the physical Hilbert space, we add one non-trivial step was to define the inner product here, the physical inner product. Okay? And you see that here, in fact, we already implement, so contrary to the parametrized particle where we only have one constraint, here we have, in fact, six constraints because you have three Gauss and constraint and three flatness constraints just for even. A given, so we have many constraints, but even imposing only the Gauss constraint here, we can keep, you can see that here, we can in fact keep the kinematical inner product. And why is it the case? It's because the SU2 gauge theory is, so SU2 is a compact group, so it means that the gauge orbits are going to be compact. Okay, so contrary to the parametrized particle, where for the, so we had the translation symmetry, the translation for, or it was more for the time invariant, translation over time, the gauge orbit was infinite, so we had to change the physical Hilbert space. But now we have to be careful because the flatness constraint implement translation. So translation, again, we're going to get some non-compact gauge orbits here, and so we won't be able to keep just the physical inner product. We will have to, the kinematical inner product, we'll have to find a physical inner product. So again, the flatness constraint as for the Gauss, so this is the first point. So we will have to deal with this. The second point is, so the flatness constraint, again, is a complicated form expression. Oops. This is scary. Okay. As a complicated expression in terms of the triad and connection. So it's not going to be easy, again, to quantize it directly. So what we're going to do now is we're going to use the fact, and we're working with holonomy. Okay, but you remember that an holonomy, you have shown in the tutorial that an holonomy, at least, and I also mentioned it in the lecture, that you can use holonomy to characterize the curvature of, to characterize curvature. And indeed, if now I'm considering a small loop, a closed curve with length, a small length, so epsilon is the length of my curve, then what I get is that this can be written as an identity minus integration over the surface here of the flatness constraint. Oh, it's not the flatness constraint, but it's the curvature tensor here. Okay, so what does it mean here that you want, what we want to impose is f is equal to zero. Okay, so this is getting that for any closed curve, what you want is that the holonomy is identity. Okay, so really the idea here is imposing flatness, meaning f is equal to zero. Here we'll impose that you get that h is just the identity. Okay. And this is what we're going to do for, this is the way we're going to impose the flatness. So what does it mean explicitly on this graph? Okay. So on this graph, how many closed loop do you have? Okay. All the faces here are going to be a closed loop. Okay. So I have four closed loop here that I can, and what I'm going to impose is that the holonomy around each of these closed loop is going to be identity. Okay, and it's the way I'm going to impose the flatness here.
Just a question.
Yep.
The loop which is touching the ground, it can be decomposed as like, do we have to impose also this one?
Yeah, so very good. So if you impose the four of them, then you're going to get some redundancy. So we are going to impose only three of them, in fact. Yeah, very good. But let's just write explicitly the four, and then your very good remark. So we won't impose all of them. So here, but we see four loops, and we're going to see, as you just mentioned, is that they are not independent. But just to make sure, so we have. So I'm going to define. What is the notation I used here? One, so four, five, six. How did I use that? Okay, so let me write how I define my holonomies, but I'm not sure what was the logic behind my notation, but maybe it's going to become clear in a moment. So my first loop is the one at the back, okay? So I have an orientation. So I'm going this way. So the first one is G4 inverse, okay? Then I have, no, I'm going this way. So what am I doing? Okay, so let me write it explicitly and then check with you the orientation. So G4 inverse, then I said G5, G6. Well, here I'm considering the holonomy associated to each edge. So is that consistent with, yeah, okay. So when G4 inverse, G5, G6, okay, and the way I'm multiplying the holonomy has to be consistent with the way I define my holonomy, but I think this way is consistent. Then H2 is going to be G2, G1, G6, so this face. So so G6, G1 inverse, G2 inverse. Okay, so now, yeah, the multiplication. So I start with G6, sorry, going along the edge 6. And then it's not the right orientation, so it's J minus 1 and then J2 minus 1. Okay. Now H3 is, so G2, I'm starting G2, G3, inverse, G4 inverse, G2, G3, G4 inverse, so it's this one. And then I'm left with the bottom one, which is H4. And I let you check. But as Jeremy already noticed it, indeed they are not all independent. You have that H4 is going to be can be written as J6. H2. So you see that if now I impose in that each of these, so what I'm going to do to impose the flatness, I'm going to, so I'm starting with my state and I'm going to impose this delta function where it's a delta on the group. So delta on the group is saying that this element has to be identity. So let's say that right now I'm just saying that for each closed loop, I should impose that the holonomy associated to this closed loop has to be identity. So this is the way I'm going to define my physical state. But here we have to be careful in this case, in this example, because indeed we have this relation. So what does it mean now? This means that if I impose in that these three group elements as our identity, then this is going to be also by automatically H4 is going to be identity. So in fact, in order to avoid some redundancy here, I'm going to get rid of this. So I'm getting rid of this one.
Can you explain why phi is n to delta, delta, delta phi?
Yeah, so here, this is, I'm starting, so here the phi is not going to be anything. I'm going to start with the spin network that we just wrote for this specific graph. Okay, so I'm going to rewrite it. But so starting from this spin network associated to this graph, now I want to implement the flatness constraint. So this means that for the way I'm doing it is I'm asking that each closed loop here is going to be sent to identity. So here, when I'm writing that, what is this? I'm going to write explicitly what is the delta function on the group. What does it mean that I have a delta function of the group? This means that if I'm applying this delta function on a function on my group, okay, What does it mean here? This means that I'm selecting the element where this is equal to identity. Okay. So here, what do I get? I just get f of g. Okay, so here it's not well written, okay? It's because we need some integration. Of course, it's some delta function to really define what is my state. But really, the idea is that I'm imposing that each of these holonomies on the closed loop are going to be fixed to identity. Okay, and this is the way I'm going to impose the flatness. Where here, this is the delta function. On the group. Okay, so the first issue here was about that we didn't, all of them are not independent. So if I impose the four identity here, I'm going to get some infinity going on. But now the next issue we need to deal with is we need to find what is this physical inner product. And in fact, what we can use here is, so what we want, so for any, so here the idea is that we impose a delta of a constraint, meaning that we want this constraint to be zero. So here the way we're going to do it is by imposing that each holonomy on a closed loop is going to be zero. But so let me restart. So what I want to say here is that we have to be careful, since we are dealing now with non-compact gauge orbit, that now we're going to get that. This is going to be different. But there is a kind of recipe that you can, it's not the one we use explicitly in the case of the parametrized particle, but you can check that this could work in the case of the parametrized particle, because we're going to use the fact that when we have a self-adjoint operator, C, which is also, in addition, we want, so what, how do we want to define our constraint? We want that it's a self-adjoint operator, and here we're going to define it as a projector, as we did for the Gauss constraint, meaning that, oh, if you want, C. So this is a projector. So once we have this, the way we can define the physical inner product is, so here what this is telling you, that it's self-adjoint, is tell you that this is just the definition. And so using these two properties, a way to define the physical inner product, I'm not going to do it here, but you could check that this could work in the case of, so instead of imposing okay, so this is what we want to get, saying I start with two states defined in my kinematical Hilbert space, then applying the constraint on these two states is going to define my, or if you want, it's more delta, is going to define what are my physical states. And I want, of course, to have a physical inner product defined for this physical state. But using the fact that if we can define this operator as self-adjoint and that this delta here, it's more here the delta, are going to be project as projector, the way we're going to define the physical inner product is going to say that this can be also done by just applying our constraint on C2 and using then the kinematical Hilbert space. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. So in our case, what does it mean? I'm going to write it explicitly. But first, if you want to convince yourself as an exercise, you can check, because for the parametrized particle, in fact, we haven't done really this because we knew the result from the fact that we know how to quantize the free particle, okay? But you can check that for the parametrized particle with just C, the constraint was just where H would be the Hamiltonian for the free particle. Then you can check if you different. Sorry, so you get this. Acting on a state as, so it's a state living in the kinematical Hilbert space, so it's a function of T and Q. Okay. But you can, so this would be defined like this. The integration, so you have some factor. And here you have some integration of on your state. So this would be the way to define your projector. So I let you check that indeed the physical, you get the physical inner product that we define. So check for the parameterized particle that the physical inner product can be obtained using this prescription, okay, using this equation here, and that you're going to recover. Okay, so this is what we're going to use in our case. And so what does it mean explicitly here? This means that we're going to, what we want to do, we are going to define our physical inner product this way. We impose that the three delta function, so the three closed loop, the holonomy around the three closed loop is the identity. So this is going to be same thing as saying where here we can just use the kinematical inner product. I guess I mixed one and two here. Okay, so this is what we're going to do. Where here, what is so psi one or any of the psi is going to be, so it's a spin network associated to this graph. Okay, so I already defined it. So it's a function of, I can use it defining like this, associated to my tetrahedron. It's a function of so this is just for notation. And in fact, here I'm summing over this, all these indices, where I'm introducing this function where here, this is just what I defined this morning, meaning this is a product of my four three J symbols, so my four intertwiner here. And then G3, G4, G5. So this is just what I defined this morning as the spin network associated to this graph. And here I need to add my magnetic number. And depending if, for this given vertex, the edge is incoming or outgoing, then I get either the M magnetic number with a sign minus or the N magnetic number. And and 6, and 4, and 3. Okay, and of course I can define similarly. It's going to be also a spin network associated to this state 100 with different irreducible representation associated to each edges and different intertwiner. In fact, here to be very correct, I should also add that this all the vertices are labeled by a given intertwiner. Okay. So it's just because it's associated to the graph, which is, you know that a spin network. So the spin network, as Katharina just reminded us, is labeled by a graph. Okay. And the irreducible representation associated to each edges, and then the intertwiner associated to each vertices. Okay. So here I'm it's just a way to say that the graph is it's a tetrahedron, my graph. Okay, and then I'm just specifying the irreducible representation. So you have 6 edges, and then, you know, since we have only 3 valent vertices here, the intertwiner associated to a 3 valent vertices is unique up to normalization. Okay, it's a Clebsch-Gordan coefficient, or if you wanted the 3G symbol, but we just Katharina just remind us here. And since the magnetic number are summed here, at the end you just only have this number.
It's not like a function or?
No, here it's not a function, it's this function if you want. Okay, it's just to remind you that it's a graph with the tetrahedron. Good one, this one. Okay.
So the G1, G2, G3, G4, G5, G6 is not an intertwiner.
Sorry?
No, it's okay. I got it.
So which one is not an intertwiner?
No, it's not that it was like an intertwiner with only J, which was surprising.
Okay, so now here it's really the spin network here associated to this graph. What I'm trying to do now I'm starting with this graph. I know how to write a state in which is SU2 gauge invariant for this given graph. Now I need to implement the flatness constraint. Then I will get the physical state. Okay. But what are you expecting, in fact, here? So as I told you, this can be really seen as the graph living on the two sphere. So our canonical surface here is a two sphere. Okay, so the topology of a two sphere, of course, is trivial, and we are doing the quantification of 3D gravity. So 3D gravity as if on a trivial topology as zero or anyway as always zero. Local degrees of freedom. So here we are doing the quantification of gravity, 3D gravity, on a trivial topology. So what are we expecting to get at the end? We're expecting to get one physical state, which is because we don't expect any physical degrees of freedom. Okay? Is that clear? Everyone is lost, so maybe let's do this computation explicitly and see what we get. But I'm not going to give all the details because most of the details are. Yeah, you need to write. It's again some recoupling magic, as Katharina said. But even more complicated, so I'm not going to give all the details. Just what I want to say is which kind of object we get. And in fact, again, this object has a nice geometrical interpretation. We're going to, again, see this object when we're going to deal with spin foam model in 3D gravity. Okay. So what does it mean that we compute this physical inner product between these two states. This means that we look at the transition between, it can be seen as the transition amplitude between these two these two states here. So what we are computing really is, so it can be really seen as the transition between a state labeled by this gi prime. Okay. And so implementing this delta function, so using this trick here, what I'm going to get is just, so I need to integrate over the six. I'm doing some delta function, okay, for the group. So I'm going to integrate over six copy of my group. And I'm just going to rewrite. So psi 2 is defined like this, with the prime index. And now I'm just evaluating so I'm evaluating for the group element GE. So instead of now this basis, I have the Wigner matrices. So here I have a product of Wigner matrices and it's a complex conjugate. So here and so this is psi 2. Then I have, of course, psi 1, and I'm going to implement the delta function. And now, so here I'm just really just rewriting everything in the SU2, in the holonomy representation. Okay, so instead of my vector basis, now I'm dealing with Wigner matrices. Yeah, so instead of E here, I need I. And I have my three delta function written in terms of the J, I. And here I can just use the measure on the kinematic space, so meaning the R measure. Okay. And so here, if you do some recoupling theory, so you can, everything you see is, so you're integrating over six group elements. This is written in terms of the six group elements. And here the H, you have the H can be decomposed in terms of the G. Okay, so this can be really compute explicitly, and you get a really well-known object in SU2 recoupling theory. So here, it's again, I'm going to give you just the result, and we're going to see what does it mean. Okay. So here, I get some factor of dimension, so normalization is a prime. And here what I get is two of these objects. Where here, this is, so now this is really a function, Jeremy, contrary to here where this was just a notation. And many things here. First, what is that? So this is what we call, so this is a function, and it's a function that you get from some recoupling theory. It's called a 6G symbol. Okay, and it really comes from gluing together. So here you start with four vertices. Okay. And so what was telling you the Gauss constraint? Okay, so you started with, as Katarina recalled us, you start with, you consider that now you have a graph, and all the kinematical Hilbert spaces in this graph can be seen as independent. Okay, so you just take the tensor product of all these kinematical Hilbert spaces. Now we need to, so this is the kinematical Hilbert space associated to a given graph. And again, once you are considering the kinematical Hilbert space associated to a graph, this means that here we are considering a truncature of the full theory, and we just consider a finite number of degrees of freedom. And if you want to go to the continuum theory, then you need to take a projective limit at this stage, but we haven't discussed that here because already at this truncated theory, we can already impose the constraint. So this is kinematical completely. Then we're going to impose the Gauss constraint. So we get this spin network state, where what we have done here is at each now vertices, okay, we are putting together all these edges. Okay, so these edges now are not independent, or the kinematical, the Hilbert space associated to each edge now cannot be. Oh, if you want, let me restart. So the kinematical, the Hilbert space now associated to this part of the graph cannot be decomposed as a tensor product over the three edges anymore. Okay, because you constrain, you introduce some constraint which is going to constrain the magnetic number associated to this part of these edges. And so this is not independent anymore. This is now given by an intertwiner. Okay? So what is the Gauss constraint doing? It's really connecting all the edges together. Okay? And now we need to impose the flatness constraint. So what is this flatness constraint? So at this point, the theory can be, instead of being seen as edges putting together, okay, now you can see more independently each vertices. Okay? At this stage, you could see each vertex more or less independent of each one another. But now we're going to impose the flatness constraint. And the flatness constraint is going to say, no, all these vertices are not independent. The way they are glued together is constrained by the flatness constraint. And here, what is really telling you, if you go to the semi-classical picture where you still have a discrete geometry, is really telling you that, okay, so the way, so this is my vertex V. Okay, so I have my three vertices here. So what is doing my Gauss constraint is instead of having these three independent, is saying me, no, they are not independent and they are coupled in a way that here, the dual picture is a triangle with some well-defined, okay, property. So now you see that at each vertex, you have four vertices like this. And now at these four vertices, in fact, you can see that as a small triangle where the area, the length of the, is well defined with the, so let's do it like this, even if then we cannot glue them so easily. So it's given by all these quantum numbers are going to characterize the area, the angles, and the length of these vertices. Okay, so now, once you have imposed the flatness, the Gauss constraint, what you get is four triangles, which could be seen as independent. And now you still have the flatness constraint to impose. And what the flatness constraint is going to tell you, I don't know why I'm still trying to do this wrong way. Okay, so this is the dual. Okay. So now what the flatness constraint is going to tell you is how to glue together this triangle, okay, in the dual picture. And the way you do that is really you glue them in such a way that this form a tetrahedron, which is embedded in a flat spacetime, okay? And this is the geometrical interpretation of this flatness constraint. So you see, you start with just independent edges. You implement the Gauss constraint. This is going to tell you that you have some constraint at each vertices of these edges. They cannot be independent edges anymore. And then you impose the flatness constraint, and it's going to tell you how these vertices are embedded together, okay? So this is the picture. So so what is important here? So these are a quite important object. It can be seen, it can be shown related to some geometrical property of a tetrahedron, okay? And we're going to see that when we are going to talk about the spin-form approach in 3D, you're going to show that indeed the spin foam can be written in terms of this 6J symbol. And why is it talking about gravities? Then if you go to the semi-classical limit, meaning J now goes to infinity, or we're going to show, then what you get is that this object is going to go as the cosine of the Redshift action. And what is the Redshift action? Is an action which describes discrete gravity. Okay, so here you're still at the discrete level, but indeed, if you go to the limit, here what you get, you recover the Redshift action, which is a discrete description of gravity. So this is the first point. Then what is important here is then you see that here the so we were trying to compute this inner product here between two different states. And what do we get is that this inner product factorizes. Okay, so what does it mean? This means that there is only one independent physical state, and that the physical state is one-dimensional, which reflects indeed that the radius phase space for a spherical spatial hypersurface, so the two sphere here, has a zero-dimensional radius phase space. Okay, so here this is. Okay, so here, what do you get? You get that the 6J symbol, if we normalize it, is the physical state in using the spin network basis. Okay. So here we are talking. For the triangulated two sphere and so we have only coming from this equation, what we see is that we have one independent physical state. So this means really that the Hilbert space here, or the physical Hilbert space, is one dimensional. And this is really reflecting that the radius phase space for a spherical hypersurface, so the two sphere here, has a zero dimensional radius phase space. Okay. Okay, so here you really quantize 3D gravity. Okay, so starting from we started from even the Einstein-Hilbert action, then we rewrote this Einstein-Hilbert action in terms of the triad and connection, okay? So the first order formalism of gravity. And then we did the canonical analysis of this action, and we applied the Dirac program. Of course, to solve the constraint at the end, we need really to, you cannot really do that in general. So we specified which canonical surface we consider, what is the graph we work with, and then we impose the flatness constraint on this graph. And we recover an expected result, which is that there is only one independent physical state in this case. And again, this 6J symbol, we're going to see that we recover that if we do now the spin foam approach. And that Okay, so now if you have some questions, because the next tomorrow what I want to do is to talk about 4D gravity. So to tell you what we have done, what is, can be exported directly to 4D gravity, and where the difficulty comes from in 4D, and where we are in the loop quantum gravity approach in the canonical approach, so in loop quantum gravity in 4D. And then on Wednesday, I will mention the spin foam approach, which from my point of view is not as well defined as the canonical approach. And I also think that you cannot learn as much as doing really carefully the canonical approach. So that's why I spend only time on canonical approach. But I will tell you what is the idea of the spin foam, what is the motivation, the idea, and what are the results we have. And then Thursday and Friday, you will have invited lecture. So if you have questions now, or because I don't think I'm going to start 4D gravity, I prefer to give you some time to. Okay, this was clear. Yeah, I prefer to give you some time to just digest this and think about 3D gravity. And then tomorrow I will rewrite a kind of big picture of the 3D gravity we have and step by step what we did, which kind can be generalized to 4D, what are the differences, and where we are stuck. And then hopefully you will have a kind of big picture. Yeah.
Say if we triangulated our sphere differently, put more triangles on, what would our result be?
So in 3D, since it's a topological theory, in fact, you can always, all more complicated triangulation can be obtained by what we call Packner move, which are just, in fact, dividing all these triangles into, for example, two triangles or tetrahedron into two tetrahedron. And then, but it's just topological move. And in fact, you can show, so this symbol satisfies what is called the Biedenhardt identity, and all these Packner moves. So geometrically, on your graph, you can do this Packner move to get to a more complicated or more simple graph. And you can show that this Packner move can be, at the algebraic level, can be encoded into the Biedenhardt-Eniot identity, where, in fact, everything, so it's some product of sigj symbol, which is going to simplify all the time to a symbol, sigj symbol. So you can, yeah. In the case of 3D gravity, since it's topological, you really have this only independent physical state. So even if you start from a more complicated triangulation, you can go back to that. Yeah.
If it's on a torus.
Yeah, so then if it's on a torus, then you're going to get some global structure appearing here. So we get some, you need to take into account that indeed in the torus, then you will have two non-independent curves. So yeah, I haven't done explicitly the triangulation of a torus.
Do you get more than one state, or do you still just get one state?
So I don't know exactly how you will write it. Just what I, so what I know is that what you're supposed to get some kind of, so it's going to depend on the characteristic of your torus, meaning the length, for example, of one of the and the other. And but then, yeah, I don't know exactly how you get the state. More question? Need more time? So, Jeremy, is that fine for you? You're going to
talk about that.